soir. Notice anything different? I'm not smoking. And it's great. I saved so much money that I bought myself my own bar. It's called Buddies. You're sitting in it. Now that I own a gay bar, I can't stay in the closet anymore. I'm as high profile as a city councilor. Of course, it's becoming next to impossible for anyone to stay in the closet anymore. But with all those hapless celebrities being dragged out by the press. That must be terrible. Millions of people going, ew. I'll bet Richard Chamberlain had a couple of sleepless nights. Oh, I'm not saying he's gay. I'm just saying I hope he has a good lover. Because he's gonna need a lot of sex with a man to help him through this crisis. Good luck, dick. Why is being outed considered such a bad thing? When I find out someone is gay, my admiration for them increases tenfold. Well, not everyone. I still refuse to believe Liberace was gay. I just don't want him to be. Him and Roy Cohn. It's like being told Satan's a fag. Maybe that's why God's such a homophobe. And Satan's so sexy. Maybe if more people came out, there wouldn't be so many fag-bashing comics around. I mean, really, what's the problem, boys? Let me just say one thing. Charge. Sam Kinison must be harboring some mighty memories to be so terrified of fags. I mean, why is it always the big smelly guys who think all fags want them? Oh, I'm not saying he's gay. I'm just saying he used to be a preacher. Andrew Dice Clay is phonier than Milli Vanilli. He's wearing the Emperor's new clothes. It's as if someone took your grandmother, the one who can't speak English, taught her to swear phonetically, gave her a special on HBO, and made her a star. It's not the dirty words. I have enormous respect for filth. It's the hate. Andrew Dice Clay is not the new Lenny Bruce. I am. He and Eddie Murphy are just pissed off because they give off such a faggy vibe. I'm not saying they're gay. I'm just saying they sure smell like rough trade to me. And the saddest thing of all is, I'd still like to have sex with both of them. Oh, sure, I'd feel guilty. But you know what? All I think it would take is about 20 bucks. This is great. I feel like Farrah Fawcett in Extremities. Anyways, there'll be none of that hatred here at Buddy's. Just family entertainment for the queer nation. No stand-up comedy allowed. A place where the brothers can be sisters, the sisters can be parents, and I can be sibling. I'm not saying I'm gay. I'm just saying, boys, you don't want to run into me in a dark alley.
Hey, everybody, this is Jim David, and that is, of course, Scott Thompson from the kids in the hall doing his famous Buddy Cole routine. I'm sure you've seen Buddy Cole. He is the gay barfly who just sits at a bar with a martini and philosophizes. And it's the character that made Scott famous. And before we get to Scott, by the way, this is a really great interview and incredibly personal and very honest. I was surprised at where the interview went. But I just want to put in a plug for my novel again, You'll Be Swell, because I'm happy to say that the novel is finally in the black. It is in profit. And if you order it now, I'll actually get some of the royalties. You can get it on Amazon or Kindle or for your iPad on iTunes or for your Sony e-reader or your Barnes & Noble Nook. But it has passed a sales milestone. It's done very well. I'm very happy. And I'm finally making tens of dollars from it. So order it now. But anyway, back to Scott. Scott is a very well-known Canadian comedian who's most famous for the kids in the hall. He was also on the Larry Sanders Show. He was on Reno 911. He's done every talk show you can think of. I worked with him a couple of times on Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn. And he also has a recurring role in a new series this fall called Hannibal. But anyway, you'll have to look for that. But now, I think you'll really enjoy this interview with Scott Thompson.
Oh, you were raised in Toronto.
Well,
no, in Canada.
Canada.
Where in Canada?
Well, my first 9 years were in a place called North Bay.
Uh-huh.
And then my parents took us out of Paradise when I was like 9 down to Brampton, which is a town outside of Toronto, which was a small town when I was there, but now is the fastest growing city in the country.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So, I'm from Ontario my whole life, the north and then the south.
Yeah.
What about you?
Me? I'm from Western North Carolina.
Oh, God, what southern boys aboard.
Yeah. And then I went to college in South Carolina, and then I went to grad school in Dallas, and then I got kicked out of grad school.
I was kicked out of school myself.
Really?
Yeah.
Where?
At York University. I was kicked out in my final year, going into my fourth year. They kicked me out for discipline. They said I was uncontrollable. And they had a point, but they shouldn't have kicked me out. They should have worked with me.
Why?
Oh, I was a handful.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I was very, because I had no experience. I was in theater school. I studied acting. I was going to be a legitimate actor, and I was going to be funny on talk shows. That was my grand plan. I had no intentions of being a comedian. And going into my fourth year, every year, at the end of every year, I was on probation. And then I would do something that would make them have to go, maybe we'll keep him. And then the third year, I did this one-man show. And I was late a lot, and I was very subordinate to my teachers. And
me too. Yeah. I stuck my tongue out at a nun in the seventh grade. And I had to come on Saturday and rake leaves.
Yeah, well, of course, you're a comedian.
Yeah.
And
I hated I thought it was like a concentration camp, that Catholic school.
Well, this is just like a regular university. Like, I was in a theater school, and they had no time for comedy. They were all about Shakespeare and Brecht and all this other stuff. And I would do cabarets, and they would never come see them. And then I would do things like, my final year, we all do one person shows, like little presentations, and I did Montgomery Clift, who I'm obsessed with. And I did this little, I had dyed my hair black, and I got a great suit, and I put this whole little story together about Montgomery Clift. And then what happened, my friend was supposed to do, he had the tape recorder, you know, cassette tapes and all that.
Of course.
And it jammed during my performance, and I had a complete meltdown. And then I dropped a glass, and it shattered. And then I walked in it I was barefoot, and I started bleeding everywhere, and I ended up...
God, aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you enjoy the show?
And it ended up with me crouched in a corner, weeping with my bloody feet. And in a way,
that's a hell of an opening night.
Yeah. And I mean, when you're doing a one-person show about Montgomery Clift, you should know it's not going to end well.
Exactly, but bleeding?
Bleeding.
He was in a car crash.
No, and I was, and it's also, this is like, you know, this is like just the punk era's beginning, so it was all about, I was real, I was bleeding, I was crying, and they kind of would go, we think you're like kind of sick, but there's something about you. But they didn't really realize that I wasn't sick. Was a comedian.
Uh-huh.
But they didn't know that. And I didn't.
You didn't know it either.
No, because, you know, in those days, the idea, a comedian is someone who talks about their life. I couldn't talk about my life.
Why not?
Because I was homosexual. And I couldn't talk about the truth, so I thought I'd be an actor, and I'd disguise myself and be a movie star. Well, I remember being in at theater school. My third year, I went to the Banff School of Fine Arts for a summer to study musical theater. And that was the year that I decided I did my very first stand-up performance and in a cabaret. I was a mess. I remember being completely soaked and all. It was my very, very first performance.
Good Lord, your first, you've got a, the first show about Montgomery Clift, you end up bleeding.
Bleeding.
And this is, you're soaked.
And soaked in a melt, not a meltdown, but it was just, I had no real material. I just was kind of talking about my troubled childhood. But I never really dreamed I could be a comedian. And then they kicked me out of school going into my fourth year. They said that they couldn't deal with me any longer. I remember very clearly I had a meeting with all the, and I was the only person kicked out that year. And they had all my faculty teachers were there. And they had said, we've all discussed that we can't deal with you any longer. And then they dismissed me. And so I got up.
We can't deal with you anymore.
We can't handle you. So I got up and I closed the door and I turned around. They're all there. And they said, what are you doing? I go, well, you've had your say. I'm going to have my say. And one of the teachers came up to kind of push, make me leave. And I pushed him and made him sit down. I said, you're staying put. And I locked the door and said, you are going to remember this. I will be the most famous non-graduate ever from this school.
And you were.
And I was.
How about that?
Yes. Up until now, it was Kate Nelligan, which people don't really know anymore.
Of course they do.
They do.
Of course they know Kate Nelligan.
But it was Kate Nelligan was when the whole, I would go, I'll be more famous than Kate Nelligan.
And you
think
are.
I think I am.
Well, especially with, you know, Kids in the Hall.
And then I went out into the world and tried to become a serious actor. And I was very, very unsuccessful. And maybe a couple of years after graduating, I was brought to a midnight performance by my friend Darlene to see someone called, it's a group called the Kids in the Hall. And it was like a bolt from the blue, love at first sight. There was like 8 or 9 of them at the time. We were all just kids. They were like teenagers. And I remember turning to her and saying, I'm going to be in that group.
Really?
Yeah. And she said, you don't even know them. I go, yeah, but they need me. And it was one of those moments in my life when everything was very, very clear. And
who was in the group? Was Dave Foley in it?
Absolutely, yeah.
And Mark McKinnon?
Dave Foley, Mark McKinney, Bruce McCullough, Frank Van Keeken, Gary Campbell, Luciano Casimiri, and Sandra Seamus. Those were the people. And maybe Norm Hiscock that night. So there's a ton of them. But they all eventually left after I started performing with them.
What did you do? Did you just go say, I want to be in your group?
No, here's what happened. They had a thing, and it was a midnight show, and they taped donuts underneath. They had donuts taped under the seats for some reason. And
they had donuts?
Donuts for a sketch they were going to do later.
Oh.
And I took the donuts, and I started throwing them I just started whipping them at them. I wanted them to remember me. And then later, when they were all, everybody was just hanging out, I said, I'm the guy that threw donuts. And they were like, what kind of an asshole does that? But it was just, I had to be noticed by them. And then I was in an improv group called the Love Cats. And we were all improv. The improv scene was very big in Toronto at the time. And I was notorious for just, my team was notorious for just being crazy. And I just had no inhibitions on stage. And I was notorious for wearing pantsuits. And I had like my hair spiked up and I'd glue cigarette butts to my ear. And sometimes I would dress in drag or.
God.
I would, just crazy. And I'd walk around in like overalls with no underwear that would be slashed down to my knees. And I just was kind of like a madman. I was also singing in a band with a punk band at the time. We were called Mouth Congress, and which is Kama Sutra for oral sex. And and they would watch me and go, man, this guy's nuts. We got to have him. And then they had me do a guest appearance at the Rivoli, which is where we started out, one night. And I brought a bag of wigs and a couple of dresses from Goodwill. And I became indispensable. And I wrote a piece, my first piece I did it the other night. When I was coming out to my parents. They're all kind of at the same time coming out, becoming a comedian. They were very much the same time. You know, AIDS, comedy, coming out. And, I mean, not me AIDS, I mean the world AIDS.
Yeah.
Make that clear. So I just, and at the time, I think partly I was, the reason I was so reckless, in the 80s, there was a feeling of like, oh my God, are we even going to survive this?
Right.
So I thought, well, none of us might make it, so let's go for broke. And so I did. And that's when I came out. And I came out the same time I met, around the time I was meeting them. And then I wrote the first Buddy Cole monologue. And that
Buddy was... Cole, where did Buddy Cole come from?
Well, it was my friend Paul Bellini and I. We were so terrified by AIDS in our little group that we basically spent most of our time getting high and making little stories up in his basement on a camera, one of the very first video cameras.
Sure, in the 80s.
Yes, and so rather than, I was so terrified of having sex. And there was a guy that I was seeing, Carole Beauchamp, a French boy, and he was really, really beautiful. He was very effeminate. It was the first time I'd ever allowed myself to, you know what I mean? Like a feminine guy, effeminate. And he was very effeminate, but he had balls. You know, like a queen with balls. Mm-hmm. He was a real turn-on for me. And he was one of the first to go. He died like very early in the epidemic. One thing he said to me, this is where Buddy was born. One day he said to me, sure, I was born yesterday, but I still went shopping. And that was the seed where Buddy grew from. And I took that one line, and then I started improvising with Paul in his basement. And I was so afraid of doing that kind of effeminate voice, because I thought, you and your mom would say, if you make that face and the wind changes, your face will stay like that. I was afraid that if I started camping, I would never be able to come back. But then I started developing this alter ego as Buddy Cole. And that's where he was born.
Yeah, I read the book.
You read Buddy Babylon.
You gave it to me.
I did. Oh, yeah.
You gave it to me years ago, yeah.
So, and if you read the dedication, it's dedicated to Carole Beauchamp.
Oh, okay. Yes. Carole was the very effeminate guy.
Yes.
Okay.
And Carole is a...
Now, what did Kids in the Hall first go on television?
Our very first TV special was in 1989.
And how did you guys get that? Somebody just saw it from CTV and...
No, CBC.
CBC.
What had happened was Lorne Michaels was going back to... Remember, he'd taken a few years off during the Gene Domanian years.
Yeah, Saturday Night Live. Yeah,
Saturday Night Live. And he was coming back to Saturday Night Live. And so he went on a North American scouting trip. And he was told by, I think, Dan Aykroyd. It was the Canadian connection.
Mafia.
That's basically it. Yes, Dave Thomas's wife.
And Bill Murray was Canadian.
No, he's the one that he's Canadian, but he's not.
Oh.
Aykroyd is the Canadian.
He's the only one?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Gilda Radner, no, she wasn't Canadian either, but everyone thinks she was. We did. You mean the original cast?
Yeah.
The original cast, Dan Aykroyd.
That was it.
But anyways, it was SCTV. It was that SCTV route. Dave Thomas's wife, Pam Thomas, who was a manager at the time, and Diane Pauly, who's Sarah Pauly's mother.
Uh-huh.
They were managers and agents, and they came to see us one day, and then I think Pam told Dave Thomas, and he told Martin Short, and then Martin Short told Dan Aykroyd, and Dan Aykroyd told Lorne Michaels.
And Lorne Michaels came to see you?
Yes.
And produced your first television special.
Yes, and so they arranged for us to do a showcase for Lorne. And Lorne came with his people, and there was this little club, and it was packed.
Did you do Buddy at that first showcase?
Mm-hmm.
With the martini,
yeah.
Sitting at the bar?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
at this point, had you decided to be and that you were going to be out?
Absolutely, yes. And I had a long talk with Lorne about that, because Lorne sat me down and basically said to me that this is a decision you're going to have to make. It's up to you. Now, you can stay in the closet, and maybe these aren't his exact words, but the gist was, if you stay in the closet, you'll have a remarkable, wonderful career. But if you don't, it probably won't play out like that. He might have been a little blunter with his language.
Uh-huh.
And at the time, I went, well, I don't think I have a choice.
Mm.
And so I didn't realize how right he was.
Oh, really?
No, he was right.
Why?
Because it did play out that way. After the Kids in the Hall ended, and
how long was the Kids in the Hall on?
6 years.
Yeah.
Did
you ever get hate mail?
Oh God, yes. Mm-hmm. And hate talk and hate people saying things to me all the time. But I just didn't feel I had a choice. I was a little naive. I don't regret it. It's the thing I had to do. But he basically said, you know, this is the world's not ready. And also AIDS was ravaging the community. And I just went, I have no choice.
And you were one of the first.
Yes. And I think after the Kids in the Hall, you know, I went to Larry Sanders. I mean, you had this great run. But I played a gay man. And I believed at the time that I'd be allowed to play anybody. But I was not. And so after Larry Sanders, I had a long period of basically playing neutered gay men.
Right.
You know, like people that are not essential to the story. And I was always like, I'm essential to the story. And I fought it and fought it and fought it and fought it. And the world was just not ready for it. And even when things would come up, even great gay roles at the time, like Jeffrey and Tu Wong Fu and movies like that, I was up for all those, As Good As It Gets. But at the very end, when it would be between me and Greg Kinnear, me and Patrick Swayze, it always went to them.
You know, I auditioned for that part.
Which part?
The Greg Kinnear part.
So did I.
They called me in.
Me too.
And I didn't get it.
Me neither. We can both be sitting here with our Oscars.
I know. I can say, after I saw the movie, I said, well, of course they gave it to Greg Kinnear. He was famous.
He wasn't that famous. No, he wasn't.
He was famous, more famous than me.
Not me. I was more famous than he was.
Really?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know.
Well, they didn't give it to you.
No, they didn't. And that's okay.
That reminds me of that line in the movie, The Producers, when he says, the guy's auditioning, and he says, I auditioned for the role of Hamlet at the Syracuse Repertory Theater. And then he said, what happened? I didn't get it. Something like that. I can't remember what it was.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, right. But still, I mean, but you had, I mean, I certainly knew about you in the 90s, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yeah, and I was like, oh my God, this guy's, I think you were the first out male on television.
Yes.
The first out female was Kate Clinton.
Okay.
Because she was out in the 80s on this show called In the Life on PBS.
Yes, I remember that, yeah.
I was the first out male comedian to have my own Comedy Central special.
Oh, really?
Elvira Kurt had done one before me.
Of course, Elvira.
So she was the first. She was the first gay person.
Yeah.
But then I was right after her.
Mm-hmm.
And so you and I are both pioneers, young man.
Yes.
We had no choice.
We had no choice.
But to be homosexuals in public. We had no choice but to fling our cocks at the public, to fling our penises and force our lifestyle down the throats of everybody else. Did you really get hate mail, really?
Yeah.
Did you ever do talk shows in Canada and they asked you those annoying questions?
Yes.
Like, when did you know?
Oh, God, yeah. They did a special on me for the Fifth Estate, the first season, and that sort of thing. Yeah, absolutely. And it was all those questions. How did you know? When did you know? You know. But, you know, I...
What kind of a reaction did you get from gay men about Buddy Cole? Because he was so effeminate, and he was such a stereotype with his martini.
Not the greatest.
Really?
Generally...
But here's the deal, and this is what is maddening about it. You weren't playing a mincing, worthless little... He had a whole philosophy.
That's right.
It was like that was his armor.
That's right.
To sit there with that martini and just have those quips, those Oscar Wildean quips, one after the other.
Yeah.
And I found that character to be extremely empowering because it was a very thinly veiled fuck you. Or maybe not so thinly veiled.
Not so thinly veiled. It definitely was. I consider Buddy like a warrior. And, like, he's brave. Braver than me, smarter than me. And I also knew that at the time, I had had that terrible experience at Banff where I melted down as a stand-up. And I think in many ways I went, well, I can't stand up. I can sit down. And I think he was really, in many ways, my nascent stand-up persona.
Uh-huh.
And I went, well, I can say, because like unlike all my other characters, he's a character, but he's also a voice box for me. I mean, they all are, but he really was my point of view. That's my point of view. And I would give that to him. And there were certain things I'd go, I can't really talk about this as me, because the people will feel the anger underneath. And that has to be, you know, you need to comedy, you've got to keep that back. And with Buddy, he always is in full control.
It's funny how you can put it in the mouth of a character and you can get away with it.
Yes.
That's why a drag queen can get away with saying a lot that a regular stand-up cannot get away with.
That's right.
You know, or they could get away with, but they see the problem with stand-up is they really have to like you.
Yeah.
And then they'll go with you. Yeah. They have to feel like you're a nice person that they'd want to spend an hour with.
Just and someone that they'll overlook saying horrible things, you know, once in a while.
Right.
And I couldn't do stand-up at the time, but that's what I've decided. The last few years I went, I'm going to start doing this stand-up a little more seriously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I can now.
Mm-hmm.
I've really been enjoying it, but I never throw a buddy. I'm always writing for him because I just go, nah, this is a topic for him.
Well, this is what made you famous.
Yeah, and I love him, and he did. But he was probably the thing I'm most known for with the kids in the hall.
Sure. And what about you guys getting back together?
Well, you know, we did a miniseries 3 years ago called Death Comes to Town, and that was quite, creatively, I love it. It wasn't that successful commercially. We did it for IFC and CBC, and we did a tour 5 years ago, and that was quite successful, all new material. But this last year, there's been an awful lot of talking. And so basically, we are planning something. We're doing a run in Toronto in December of all new material, a theatrical run.
So who's in the group now?
Same five. It's only been us five. Me, Mark, Dave, Bruce, and Kevin.
And Kevin.
And when I joined the kids in the hall, the others had kind of fallen by the wayside. And then there were the five of us, and we just, and I kind of knew this is the five.
Right.
And we just closed ranks and we made a vow to each other that this was it. We're in it for life.
Mm-hmm.
We cut each other's thumbs and rub them together.
Are you serious?
Not quite. But God. Almost.
Hope you were all tested.
I mean, yes, I know. It was the 80s, so there wasn't a lot of blood sharing.
No. Oh, my God. But tell me about your illness.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And how that came about.
Oh, Lord. Well, this is interesting. Well, I had non-Hodgkin's gastric lymphoma, which is non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in the stomach. And I beat it.
It's basically stomach cancer.
No, it's not. It's lymphoma is cancer of the lymph system.
Lymphatic
cancer. But it can manifest anywhere in the body where there are lymph nodes.
What happened? Were you just tired all the time, or...?
No, I'd been living in Los Angeles. It would be 2009.
Doing what?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing. Nothing. Nothing, Jim.
God.
Nothing.
It just reminds me of when I talked to Jim J. Bullock. It's like after the Hollywood Squares, he just said, and then I did nothing. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. He couldn't get a rest, you know.
Nothing. It's just angry and sad. Only and living in West Adams, and not really, things were not well, not good for me, and my health had been failing, and you know, I'd been having everything go pink eye that wouldn't go away, just little things, and then I had prostatitis and Bell's palsy.
Oh God!
And it went on for about 6 months, and I was just feeling, just weird.
I have to go to the doctor.
What?
I mean, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but what happened?
I don't have to.
Yeah,
know,
but here's what happened. And then one night, I was watching television, and I heard outside of my window gunshots, like bang, 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 like six of them, and then a pause, and then about boop, 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 bunch more, and I smelled gunpowder. And when I was a boy, I was in a high school shooting. I was 16. And I had not heard gunshots since that day. And it was one of those days that's marked me for life.
Oh, God.
Because I survived that day. And it's one of the worst days of my life, one of the best days of my life. But my theory about cancer is pretty interesting, I think. Maybe it's crazy, but I believe that day something was planted in me when I was a boy that made me run towards disaster my whole life. Because you feel alive when you survive. And I had not heard that sound since that day. And I went immediately, I was that kid again, hiding. I went into shock. And I remember smelling the gunpowder and looking around, everything slow motion, just like that day, and going, what am I going to do? Find the thickest wall. And I remember sliding down the wall and like putting my legs up and going and just like this. And I waited. And I spent like hours there waiting. And I didn't. And I waited. And then I went to bed. And the next morning, I guess I was in shock. I woke up and I had pain in my stomach. The gun had triggered the cancer.
Really?
I think so. I do believe that. And I believe in that. And that's they must be connected. Because it was almost as if, like, cancer to me is a physical, it's a spiritual, it's a moral thing. It's everything. And it's all these things have to be perfectly right for it to say, go! And I think that certain things that happened as a child, trauma, I think trauma is one of the key, one of the missing ingredients in cancer diet, in the holistic system. And I think that, and that sounds crazy, I've never really talked about this, never in a podcast. But I've been thinking about this a lot, about trauma and how it can trigger disease. But that was literally the next morning. I remember we were writing Death Comes to Town, ironically. And I remember telling the story of the gunshots, and I tried to make it funny. And I remember telling Bruce, my stomach's really hurting. And it just never went away. And that's what made me leave. Well,
you left Los Angeles.
I left Los Angeles.
And went back to Canada.
I went back to Canada because I had no health care. And I actually had 1 month left in my Screen Actors Guild health care. And so I had 1 month. So I had my very first treatment at Cedars-Sinai. And the bill was $50,000.
Of course it was.
50 grand. And I had to have for six that, of them for one.
For one
that
treatment.
That was for the CAT scan, the treatment, and some, yeah, and some consultations. And then after that, I went right back home. And I had about 5.5 months of chemotherapy, almost 6 months, and then I had a month of radiation.
And then when were you pronounced cured?
I was pronounced cured 4 years ago. Cured isn't better, because after that, the side effects started kicking in, and they were enormous and myriad. And I had maybe 29 serious side effects. My veins collapsed. My calf muscle tore in half. My hands and feet became numb like blocks of wood. I got shingles in my face. I had herpes down my throat and my nose. I mean,
good Lord.
You can't imagine. It just on and on. I mean, I grew breasts. I grew breasts. I grew breasts because my hormones were screwed up. They just went on and on and on.
God, well, you're alive and well today.
And I made it.
You made it.
I did.
Good for you.
Tempered my steel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wonderful, like being on the other side.
And now you have chapter 3.
Yes.
Coming up.
Absolutely. And I'm very energized and reinvigorated. Almost born again. That way, in terms of, you know, when you go so close to the exit, you know what I mean?
Right.
You don't want to be there. You just race away from it. And
you've looked it in the face.
Yeah. But it did. It's given me more strength than I went. I thought I had enough, but apparently I didn't.
Well, I'm glad you're here, Scott.
Thanks, Jim. Thank you.
Very, very good.